Where do you get your funny bone?
I think that a lot of it has to do with being a middle child and growing up in the middle, trying to get attention when it wasn't always available. But also, I think I've always just been attracted to it in some sort of innate way. I've always liked reading jokes and thinking about why they're funny.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with humor writer and stand-up comedian Sarah Aswell. A full, extended version of this interview is available online at our website, mtpr.org. In addition to being an arts and entertainment columnist for Forbes, she's an alum of HBO's Women in Comedy Festival. You really won't want to miss this. On your website, it notes, Sarah Aswell is a freelance humor writer and stand-up comedian who lives in Missoula, Montana. She has a husband who is a wonderful sports writer and two toddlers who are unemployed. So why aren't your children earning their keep?
I know, right? I think I have a little bit of a soft spot. I am keeping them in school right now, at least for the time being. But, I mean, those little hands can work, and I probably should look into something.
Sarah, you've been published widely and featured a few times in The New Yorker, including the piece titled The Only Kitchen Knife in Your Airbnb, written from the point of view of the only kitchen knife in your Airbnb. And I rarely ask writers this, but I really want to know, where do your ideas come from?
Well, that one was, I know this is shocking, I was in an Airbnb trying to cut up a potato and cut myself because it was the only knife in the Airbnb. And it was just, it's blunt, but you know, you start cutting very hard. And then you miss the potato. And it really, this happens all the time. And this was a Airbnb in outside of Glacier National Park. We're in the woods surrounded by 3 feet of snow. There's just no way we're going to get to another knife. But yeah, cutting up that potato, I sort of thought about what it must be like to live in that cabin all the time and what voice the knife would have. And it's this really weird, like, gothic, dramatic voice of this lonely knife who's stuck with 7 ladles and 8 colanders.
I remember I was following you on social media when your first piece got picked up by The New Yorker, and I think you had written something like, this is a dream come true. But what was it like for you to see yourself on the national scene like that?
It was a dream come true. I've always read a lot of humor. I grew up reading Dave Barry. And through college, my mom would send me his column in the mail every week back when we did the mail and syndicated newspaper articles. And then I started reading The New Yorker and the Shouts and Murmurs section. And Jack Handy is probably my biggest hero. And he has pieces in The New Yorker. So to be published alongside him was super great. It was a dream come true. It was wonderful. I read an interview with him recently, and he said that he still gets rejected from The New Yorker about 50% of the time, and that made me feel even closer to him.
Yes. I can't wait to talk about some of the mechanics of humor writing, but first, I want to introduce the listeners out there to your writing voice. And I almost died laughing when I read the piece that you wrote for She Knows called The Arguments I Imagine Ina and Jeffrey Garten Have Off Camera. Will you read a bit?
Sure. So this is Jeffrey and Ina talking to each other. Jeffrey, do you remember when we traveled through France in the early 1970s, living in a tent and spending all of our money on fresh food from exotic city markets, which you would transform into delectable, authentic dishes on a tiny camping stove? Ina. Yes, those were such wonderful days, spent just loving each other in the clear, warm light of the Paris spring. Jeffrey, I remember once you made an amazing bouffe bourguignon with the most tender cuts of filet, fresh spring carrots, delectable pearl onions, and wild mushrooms, which you picked from the mossy floor of the nearby forest, all served atop a fresh sourdough baguette. Ina, the baguette wasn't sourdough. Jeffrey, I can taste it like it was yesterday. It was a crusty, thinly sliced sourdough. Ina, I think I can remember the kind of bread I ate in a tent in Paris with my soulmate 45 years ago, Jeffrey. Jeffrey, I might sleep on the couch tonight. Ina, that sounds like a simple, elegant solution.
As I was going through your work, I was looking at the titles of some of your pieces, and one caught my eye that you had written for Reductress, called Luxurious Hand Lotions That Make It Impossible to Turn Doorknobs. And I saw that title and I thought two things at the same time. I thought, yes, I have to read this because this exact thing happened to me the other day. And my second thought was, what a frivolous use of my time. And I wanted to understand, Sarah, what's the value of writing about this kind of frivolous, like luxury hand lotions?
Right. I think that humor and comedy and even laughing is about human connection. The moment where you say, that exact thing happened to me the other day, it's important to have that moment between people to feel that emotion of belonging. A lot of humor is just that. It's just that string that goes from my heart to your heart that says, I understand you. I feel connected with you. I think that the universal is often specific and the specific is universal. So saying something so specific as that moment where you put on hand lotion in the morning and then find that you can't get out of the bathroom seems really specific and like this is the only, I am the only person in the universe that this happens to. But it happens to everybody. We just don't think about it very much.
I was telling a friend about this and she got me thinking about the subtext of that particular piece about, you know, when we invest in luxury and then it backfires, like when you spend all of your allowance on some La Mer face lotion and it gives you a rash. And I was wondering if that was in your mind when you were writing this, sort of like what it means to live a good life, but that actually makes our lives more difficult.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that when you... All comedy is also social commentary, and it should be. It can be super political. It can be, I think that's why many people get offended by comedy a lot, because there are a lot of underlying messages. But especially for Reductress, which is a humor site for women or female identifying people, a lot of that humor is extremely critical of the messages that women receive every day. Like, I think I have another lotion-related headline for them that's like, this daily routine for your face takes until your nightly routine for your face. And yeah, I mean, we're expected to put seven things on our face every morning and seven different things on our face at night. It's funny, but it's not funny.
I was looking at, again, your list of titles and clicked on an article, which is just a list of things you had written about Steve Bannon. And I was just wondering for you, yeah, how do you know when you need to write something really that shoots straight to the heart of something political and when you can divert it into the lotion realm?
Right. And I do think the lotion realm is still a realm of criticism and being angry at things. But I think it's when I can't stop thinking about something. Or often in politics, especially in the last few years, there's a lot of surreal and absurd things going on. And those are the realms of comedy. It's easy to think about what's going on and project it onto something that's funny. And humor, I think, allows us to do a few things that are difficult when it comes to politics. It allows us to talk to each other better a lot of times because we're laughing and because we have that string connecting us. But it also is a way for us to accept really difficult things, to be able to talk to them with a good attitude at least on the surface, I guess. But yeah, if I can't stop thinking about something, that usually means that there's something to write about. On the other hand, I think that any time that I write something or get on stage, that is a political act and a feminist act for me. Just getting my voice heard and representing women on stage as a comedian.
I was thinking about the craft of humor writing, and I imagine it's different from stand-up because you don't have the energy of the audience in front of you. So who do you imagine when you're writing, or how do you engage with the readership?
That's a really good question. I think I definitely have to have an audience of some sort, who's my husband mostly. He's got a great sense of humor, and I can immediately send things to him to see if he's also a tough crowd, a tough room. So I can send things to him and see if they work. But sometimes, like in that cabin when I was writing the Airbnb piece, I'm like, oh, I should write from the knife's point of view, and the knife sounds very theatrical. And he's like, what are you talking about? That is the weirdest thing I've ever heard. But when he read the final piece, it was good. But so sometimes you just have to have faith in yourself and confidence that it's funny. One thing I tell people in my writing and comedy workshops is, if you're not having fun writing it, nobody's going to have fun reading it. And that's true even in my day job where I do brand and marketing work. If I'm slogging through something, it's not funny or good. If I'm cracking myself up, if I get into the flow state, then I know that's good and going somewhere. You have to trust yourself. It's hard.
You've answered some of my other questions about, you know, who vets your work. And also, I had this image of like a writer sitting down and writing jokes that crack themselves up but fall completely flat when shared with others. But it sounds like actually you can have good instincts, that if it's funny to you often, it might be funny to someone else.
Yeah. A part of humor writing is missing the mark a lot. And that's, you know, that's Jack Handy's 50% of his stuff that you never get to read. It's part of the job. And you have to be tough about it and realize that, yeah, some jokes are only funny in your head. I was interviewing a stand-up comedian recently for Forbes. And, you know, he said the best moment of creating a joke is when it's in your mind and you haven't said it out loud yet. Because it always gets worse when you say it out loud. And then the worst part of creating a joke is when you're driving home from the comedy club and you can just hear your windshield wipers going and hear in your head what happened when you tried out your new jokes. But it's just, it's part of the territory. And some jokes crack me up so much, and they just never translate to the rest of the world.
Before we enter the world of stand-up, I would love for you to share another piece you wrote for McSweeney's called Your First CSA, A Month-by-Month Guide to Enjoying Your Farm Share. Will you read from the months May and June?
Sure. This is also based on me getting my first CSA, of course, although, if I talk poorly of anyone in the following section, that's totally made up. May, what the hell is a kohlrabi? You pick up your first CSA box. You're pretty sure that the bag of greens is spinach, and you're able to identify the garlic scapes by conducting a Google image search for curly CSA thing that smells like garlic but isn't garlic. You have no idea what the kohlrabi is. You take a picture of the kohlrabi and text it to your vegan friend. You, what is this? Vegan friend, you got a CSA share? You, how did you know that? Vegan friend, no one buys kohlrabi on purpose. You slice up the kohlrabi, make some dip, and bring it to your book club meeting. You then bring the platter of kohlrabi and the dip home from your book club meeting. And then this is June. Paul is your farmer, and now you know him. Paul hovers over you, counting the carrots with his eyes while you bag your share of vegetables at the CSA farm stand each week. Paul often contradicts himself by mentioning each time you use non-biodegradable plastic grocery bags to carry your food home, but also often professing that it's all good. Paul has dirt under his cracked fingernails. Paul wears a straw hat. Paul has a degree in philosophy, but no office wall to hang it on. He tells you this 2 weeks in a row. You avoid Paul at all costs, but when you can't, you try to mention offhand that you're reusing the same plastic grocery bags as last week. In fact, you've had them since college. I found them all floating on the wind and drifting along the river, you add once, puzzling yourself and Paul. You. Seriously, what's a kohlrabi? Vegan friend. It tastes like the part of the broccoli you throw away. Vegan friend. You haven't heard of it because it isn't good. Vegan friend, I'd rather eat pork.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with humor writer and stand-up comedian Sarah Aswell. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
Thrillist recently called you one of the best undiscovered comedians in America. What does stand-up mediate for you between your personal life and the public sphere?
You know, I started stand-up when I had two really small kids. My girls were 6 months old and 2 years old, and it was a really lonely time for me. I was freelance writing full-time at home, and I didn't have any childcare. So I was basically either taking care of children or writing, and sometimes sleeping. I just wasn't leaving my house a lot. I was pretty depressed. I might have even had some postpartum stuff going on. But comedy gave me the ability to go back out into the world and share my experience in a way that I hadn't been. It reconnected me. I mean, I had friends and everything, but there was something missing. I feel like I didn't have a voice, and it gave me my voice back. It was really great. It was a way of reconnecting. And as someone, I struggle with social anxiety. And you would think that would make me not want to do stand-up comedy. A lot of people, when I say I do it, are like, well, that's terrifying. You can't have social anxiety. But for me, it's a way that I can prepare what I want to say to the world beforehand and not be scared of what I'm going to say. And also to teach me that, hey, you can say something that bombs and it's not the end of the world. It's just a thing that happened.
I also wanted to ask you about your experience being a woman in comedy.
For sure. When I first started, there were very few female comedians in the scene here in Missoula, and there are very few anywhere for a lot of reasons. And once I started doing it, I really became interested in why the barriers exist between women and stand-up, and in recent years been interested in how to destroy those barriers. So I spend a lot of time thinking about why women aren't encouraged to be funny or why they feel it's not important to them to be funny, and also thinking about why it is important for women to be funny and what that does for us and what that accomplishes. It's not just, I know it doesn't sound as important as, you know, sexism or poverty, but I think it is all connected. Like, the same reasons that women don't go into stand-up are the reasons that we have so few women CEOs. It's the same issues.
I know you lead workshops for women in non-binary folk. And I was wondering, what are you encouraging and teaching in those workshops?
I'm really not teaching as much as I am giving a space to women to have a voice. I think one of the funnier barriers to women starting comedy is that it's unclear how to join, how to start doing humor or comedy. And men are more likely to have confidence to do that. Like often I run open mic comedy nights, and men will often walk into the bar and demand to get on stage. Like, I've never done it before, but I would like to go next, which is wonderful. That is not on them. With women, I think they often need a lot more information to get up there. It's like I read a study once about how women don't apply for jobs unless they have like 100% of the requirements, whereas men will apply for jobs even if they are sorely lacking the experience. Again, who's to say which of those two things is right or better? But with that fact being true, it's harder for women to know to get on stage. They need to know, like, how do I use a microphone? Where do I stand on stage? What do I open with? They have these really basic, they're like logistical questions about how to do stand-up. It's not how do I tell a joke? It's where do I sign up? Where's the sign-up list? Or do I have to show up 15 minutes early? It's almost like a social, they want to be socially correct with it and do it the right way. And again, it's a lot about women don't want to sort of embarrass themselves. There's much more like social worry. So just to teach them how to start, I don't really teach them how to be funny.
For you, are there parts of your life that you won't touch and turn into comedy? Because you're pretty open about motherhood and sex life and your family life and your body.
No, I don't think there's anything that I don't touch. And that's a thing I think about. I really think it's important. And we're going to talk about sexism a little more. But when you see a man do stand-up comedy, it's constant everything. They're open about everything. From, you know, bodily things to their private lives to talking about their relationships, sometimes in very shocking ways. And I found when I started doing comedy that it was much harder for women to talk openly about those types of things. I remember the first time I tried to do a joke about my period, a group of men started heckling me from the audience, like, we don't want to hear that. You know, shut up, get off the stage. And that kind of made me double down on doing it because, yeah, my period's not less, you know, not grosser than your farts or whatever men get lauded for talking about on stage. A lot of it's about audience, and I want stand-up to have a bigger, broader, more diverse audience as well as, you know, they reflect each other. The people on stage reflect the audience, and women do want to hear those jokes. I always ask the women who come to my comedy workshops why they're there. And recently a woman said, an older woman, she said, I'm here just for one reason. I've never heard a stand-up comic do a joke about menopause. And I thought that was so rad. I haven't heard that either. Like, there are very few women doing those jokes on stage. She'd never heard her voice. A lot of times I talk to women and they say, I don't like stand-up. And I know exactly what they're talking about. They don't like the type of stand-up that they've heard. I think if they heard menopause jokes, they might like it more. So it's not, and it's just not about women. It's about, you know, ageism and voices that are marginalized that aren't heard on stage as much.
I was just thinking about Indigenous comedy.
Yeah.
Do you have any awareness of where the stage is for that right now?
Here in Montana, there's an amazing scene. I can think of 5 or 6 really strong stand-ups right off the top of my head. In fact, I think that there was a show recently that was all Indigenous comics, either in Billings or Bozeman. But yeah, it's the same story there. It's just getting people on the stage. It's not anything except that logistical fact.
One of the things I've appreciated about you is how openly you speak about parenting and mothering. You also have a humor writing piece called Running Changed My Life Because I'm Getting Farther and Farther from My Home. And so I was hoping you could speak about, now that your children have grown up a little bit more, you know, what's your relationship between being a stand-up and talking about motherhood?
Yeah, and I think it's a topic, again, that doesn't get talked about a lot first in stand-up. And again, there are good reasons. Being a successful stand-up means touring most of the year, and that's almost impossible for young moms to do. So you don't hear that material because those people are at home. Yeah, my kids are older now, and I think I'm out of that rough spot. But I do think it was important for me to talk about, even if they go back and listen to it when they're grown up and are like, wow, did you like us? yes, I loved you. But also it was a really a hard time. The first time I did stand up, I picked out this cute dress to get on stage. By the time I got on stage, I had milk leaking through my dress. I had to wear my coat on stage because I had never been away from my kids that long, so long that, you know, I needed to nurse. That's hard. But now I think I go up and do stand up with a different goal in mind, which is not so much to talk about how hard motherhood is, but to be a role model for them. Like, now it's about them knowing that a few nights a week I go out and do comedy, and that's my time and my thing that I do, which is hard to explain to them sometime because it's at nighttime. You know, I miss the bedtime routine a few nights a week. But it's about showing them that a woman can be funny and that it's an attractive, fun, it's silly, it's powerful, it's feminine. Instead of, you know, you never, when you see a kid, you're never like, when you see a little girl, it's like, oh, that's a cute dress. I love your hair. That's so pretty. You're so nice. You're sweet. So quiet. You're sweet. How often do you say to a little girl, like, that was a funny joke. Like, I like that silly move. You make me laugh. So to be able to do that for my kids now is more important, I think, than the confessional parts of motherhood that I have been going through.
Sarah, we have an example of you doing stand-up at the Roxy, which is an independent theater in Missoula. And do you want to say anything about this clip before we hear it?
Sure. Again, we were talking about how the specific is universal and the universal is specific. This is a good example of that. I often hear from parents about this clip that they understand and that they were relieved to not be alone.
The other thing my daughters want to do every night is read The Ugly Duckling, and it's just so crazy. Like, most classic children's stories teach you a lesson or a moral, like, you know, the tortoise and the hare is about, like, slow and steady wins the race, and Humpty Dumpty is about how death is forever. But The Ugly Duckling, it just goes totally off the rails. Like, the moral seems to be, like, if you're ugly, it's okay, because just maybe you're a member of a different species. And in that species, you're totally hot.
I just read Lindy West's book, The Witches Are Coming, and she writes about her experience leaving Twitter. And in her former book, Shrill, she writes a lot about trolls. And I was wondering, because when I Googled you, the first thing that popped up was your Twitter account. What's your relationship to Twitter, and what's your experience been with trolls?
I have a lot of experience with trolls. It's funny. So as a writer, I get a certain type of troll. And then doing stand-up comedy, I get the sort of present-in-the-moment troll, which is the heckler. So I have hecklers and trolls in my life. I think I'm pretty good about not being affected by them, but it is hard. Sometimes I write humor criticism for Forbes, and after writing basically any piece that has any controversy in it, I could get 200 emails a day from angry people, mostly men, because I'm usually talking about issues of feminism or sexism in comedy. It's hard to wake up and the first thing that you read is that I should kill myself, especially when I think the way that it's okay is that they're telling me to kill myself because I said something about a comedian that they like. And I'm like, wow, that's funny. A lot of people should kill themselves, I guess, from that perspective. And they shouldn't. Hecklers are fun because they're there and you can talk to them. Uh-huh. The difference between trolls and hecklers is that trolls are anonymous. They'll never leave there's no way to talk back to them. Mm-hmm. They're in their little secret cave on the other side of the internet. Hecklers are right there in front of you. And I've had a lot of luck with hecklers to just approach them after the show and say, you seem upset. Like, basically, why are you sad? And I've had some constructive conversations there because we're two humans face to face. And a lot of times when they're not just drunk, they're reaching out for some reason.
I'm so struck by your sense of authenticity, Sarah, that I imagine like comedians using humor as a way of armoring themselves. And here you are willing to go speak directly to your heckler and, you know, have a human conversation.
Well, I think that, I mean, comedy is about, as we started out saying, is about a relationship or a connection. It's about relationships. That's one of the reasons I think women are so good at comedy. And if you think about humor as you writing jokes and the structure of jokes, which is all very interesting, you're missing the biggest part of it, which is figuring out how to identify with other people.
Sarah Aswell is a writer and comedian whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, Mad Magazine, and National Lampoon, among others. She lives in Missoula, Montana, where she's the managing editor at Submittable. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.